Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and joined alongside me today is a guest. It's been a few weeks, and this one I think you guys will particularly enjoy, and that is Trevor Tavell. Trevor, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Tyler. Hi, everyone.
So you work with a lot of publishers, and somebody that myself and producer Manny here were talking about the other day, is just being somebody that would be a great resource, I think, for a lot of our listeners to have on the show. So maybe give them a little bit about your background and why it is you spend so much time talking to publishers every day.
Yeah, a publisher success manager here at Ezoic, specifically in level three. Love helping publishers think of the big picture, focus on optimizations, whether it be revenue, speed, traffic, core web vitals. I'm just like a one-stop shop for publishers.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think publishers can probably relate to the one-stop shop because it is something where a lot of independent publishers, they sort of have to wear all of those different hats and often don't have anybody to lean on. And I think, you know, somebody that's, I would consider an expert inside of our building on this stuff that does it really well. I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to probably have you on, both commenting on some of the news of the day that we normally do, but then also just kind of giving some just general advice, because we were actually talking about this before we started, but you know, we've got quarter four coming up. And for those that maybe you're listening, you're like, why is that important? But maybe give them a little bit of context.
Yeah, absolutely. Quarter four is typically when we see ad rates at their highest. Think about the holidays that are coming around the corner with Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah. So advertisers typically spend more. And as a publisher, we're in quarter three right now, and we should be starting to think about how we can set ourselves up for success, whether that's updating content, creating content that we know will resonate in quarter four, can really help separate your content, your site from the pack.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that's been interesting over the last probably year and a half is, you know, ad rates have been unprecedented because, you know, so we have the ad revenue index that we maintain and largely is considered across our entire space as being an accurate sort of gauge for where ad rates are at. And since we started it, and I think 2015 is when we started like publishing the data, you know, it's been pretty linear, you know, like it looks like the stock market. Yeah, you've got your dips and dodges and stuff, but ultimately over the long span, it's headed upwards. But then in the last year, you know, we've had a bit of an ad rates recession, and the summer has been no exception, although there are signs that it's starting to pick up. The good news, I would say, for our listeners is that everyone that I've talked to in this industry and space and everybody that I've talked to on the programmatic side that's looking at sort of, you know, advertiser spending, it seems to be that we're going to see probably a more normal quarter four than what we did last year, which is good news if you're a publisher and you're making your money from ads.
Definitely. And what I'm telling a lot of my publishers is set yourself up for success. Utilize video content. If you aren't, you can link your YouTube channel to Humix, or you can create videos utilizing Flickify. And it's just updating that content. And I know we're going to be talking about the Google algorithm update. Yeah. So that's definitely something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that kind of dovetails perfectly into sort of like one of the big news stories of the past week. And for our listeners, you know, I think it's pretty hard. You know, I've been hard on Google on this show, and my SEO advice is well documented to our listeners. And, you know, my advice is always just to ignore these things and basically reevaluate in 2 to 3 months. And that'll give you a better idea of whether or not, you know, don't think of it in terms of Google, but maybe think it more of in terms of your audience. If you lose traffic, don't look at it specifically as organic. Just think of it as if you're getting less organic traffic from Google search, like imagine that's your audience telling you, or, you know, your audience giving you the feedback of, we're moving towards you or away from you. So ask yourself, like, why is it that my content is less popular now than maybe it was 3 to 4 months ago? And then make changes based on that. Because, you know, we were saying before the show, it's funny, but it's very easy to sort of overreact and mess something up. And that's the last thing you want to do right now.
Yeah. When algorithm updates happen, I tend to get a lot of emails from publishers. Sometimes the algorithm updates help with traffic, and sometimes they hurt. And when they hurt, publishers can sometimes think that their whole site is impacted.
Yeah.
And I always recommend utilizing big data analytics and seeing the specific pages that lost traffic, or utilizing NicheIQ's page booster, where you can see the top trending pages up or down, and then you can make adjustments accordingly.
The biggest issue that I see publishers run into with something like this, well, it's twofold. So I guess the sort of like intellectual sort of like approach of sort of analyzing the traffic and data is really good. The biggest thing that I see a mistake being made on is you pick any given day or time during the week. And this was like a thing that I used to do with people. I'd be like, I'd just grab something in analytics and be like, what do you think happened here? Mm-hmm. And you know, you get a lot of answers, and the answer is nothing happened.
Yeah,
it's just you pick a day, a certain day, and you know, like seasonality, you know, socio-political, who knows all the different things and factors that go into it. But if you're not looking at a large enough time scale, if you're maybe you're comparing like month over month, but like there's a big seasonal difference in your traffic, maybe in June and July normally or something like that. And so you basically want to make sure that you're looking at apples to apples, and that you're not just sort of imagining these sort of aberrations in the traffic just because it corresponds with a Google change. And then the other side of it is that you can actually find the answers. Like you mentioned using different types of analytics. Search Console itself will tell you enormous amount of data. And there's not usually an instance where you should be left going, I don't know why I lost traffic or why I gained it. You might wonder exactly why specifically Google's change maybe impacted you in the way that it did, but you're not going to actually be able to get an answer to that question, even if you maybe have a good guess, till pretty far down the road.
Yeah, I remember specifically a publisher, they lost traffic for a specific keyword. And when we did the research and we looked at that specific keyword, we saw the algorithm update promoted hospitals because it was the medical niche, and they promoted like specific hospitals, and then they went to the information. Yeah. So it's just one of those where you can't compete against a hospital for your keyword.
Well, I guess
on
you
a
could.
Blog.
I mean, some of our listeners, they're pretty savage. They might decide that, like, you know what, we got to bring them down.
We're going to create our own hospital.
Big hospital. The thing that I find interesting about it is, you know, there's been a lot of different examples that we've had over time that I've found just like it's obvious once you see it, but like you have to kind of get yourself out of the lens of thinking of it as sort of Google. And one of the things that I've talked about on the show previously is that, you know, the thing that impacts, you know, really publishers and search result traffic that you would get from someone like Google more than an update to an algorithm, if you really analyze the data, it's things like what you mentioned, where it's like they're showing hospitals at the top, there's a new carousel, there's a rich data markup on something that's taking up a larger portion of the viewport on mobile. Like those things have a tremendous impact on traffic. And you know, the reason why Google search has been so dominant for so long is that their secret is they rarely change it. Like if think about it from a user standpoint, if Google changed the way that it fed you results over the last 20 years, like every week, or it made these big dramatic changes, it'd be bad for users. Users like Google because it's, you can expect pretty much the same thing you've been able to expect for the last 20 years. And I think that there is sort of a flaw in thinking that, you know, you're going to be hit with something that's negative, because if it is negative and you are impacted by some kind of Google change, the idea that you're going to be able to go in and maybe do something small or tricky to be able to, like, you know, reverse that effect, I think it's pretty, I think that's a pretty far leap.
Yeah, whenever someone talks about, oh, Google's going to change the way they promote articles with AI and the Bard and Bing, I always laugh, because Google wants traffic to go to publishers because that's how they generate revenue.
Correct.
By displaying ads. So they don't want to hurt publishers. And at the end of the day, Google is going to promote that content that really hits EAT. And I talk about this all the time with publishers, and EAT, for those who might not know, it's expertise, experience, authority, and trustworthiness. So when you're looking at your content, do you check those boxes? Do you have experience in the niche that you're talking about? Do you have expertise? Why should users in Google trust your content over someone else? Are you an authority in the space? So those are things to think about, especially with an algorithm update or when you're creating content in general.
Yeah, and I think it's even more important now, and I'm glad you touched on it, because it really speaks to sort of like the next big news item that we've had, and it's on every show we're talking about AI. But you know, if you're not providing something unique, I've said on the show before, one of the things, unfortunately, that Google sort of robs, it has a negative connotation, but it's kind of true, because one of the things it robs from web publishers that are writing articles or written content versus, you know, you publish content to a YouTube or an Instagram, is in YouTube and Instagram, you have the comments right below, you're getting direct audience feedback. That's your audience. With Google, when Google is this layer in between, you just see that all the traffic or all the audience is quote unquote Google, you sort of lose this connection to your audience. So you kind of look at it through that lens. And what I think is unfortunate with that is that you need to make content for your audience. And, you know, some subjects you may not need to necessarily be an authority or an expert, but you should be able to provide something that people are looking for. That's why so many publishers find themselves in the positions that they are, just because they were a fan, or they were, you know, like a hobbyist that, you know, put content out there that they were looking for. And now with AI, you know, AI can make content, you know?
Oh yeah.
It can make content really well. But it lacks the humanness to be able to figure out like why somebody is going to be interested in the latest, you know, sneaker drop or something like that, or why that's cool, or sort of the backstory there. It maybe can't weave those lines and anticipate what people are going to like the same way that a human can. So I'm just sort of curious, like what types of advice have you given to your publishers, and also like I guess what bad advice, or I guess what types of advice do you see people getting out there that maybe is misdirected?
In terms of advice, you mentioned creating content that people want to go to. And I think a lot of publishers can sometimes be reluctant for video content because they made their bones with written content. But if you ask someone on the street, how do you like to get your content? How do you like to learn about things? A lot of people are going to say a video, and especially younger audience and demos, they prefer video content. So having your written content paired with video content is also going to increase your chances for impressions, because you can rank for the written and you can rank for the video. And one of the great things with Humix is you can rank for your YouTube video and you can rank for your Humix video as well. So you're just getting more opportunities for revenue and clicks. And then bad advice that I think people are getting is deleting content or removing content.
I'm with you there.
And I'm always scratching my head why people would want to delete content when you can easily update the content and make it relevant.
And also, why did you create it to begin with?
You know,
that's a fundamental question, because if you are looking at your content and you're going, I can delete this huge portion of it, like, why'd you make it? Like, that comes back to the fan thing, where it's like somebody out there probably should want that. And if you made it and it wasn't for somebody, then like, you shouldn't have made it to begin with.
Yeah, I think people are kind of chasing the news cycle tail. And sometimes they'll get an article that will rank well for that news cycle and then it'll disappear. So then they just think to discard it. And no, there's still opportunities and a life for that content if you're smart and creative about it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this kind of comes back to, you know, one of the biggest issues that I see with SEO is that advice is often given based on sort of like subjective field data, meaning it's like one person did X,
yes,
and then, you know, Y happened. And maybe that's something that you see replicated. It's like 8 people did X and they happen to have like a lot of following, or they, you know, this is somebody that's, you know, supposed to be an expert and you've heard this one a couple times. And so what happens is then you're just like, well, this is just a fact because look, everybody that does this seems to have an impact. The thing is that, you know, I'll look at 100,000 sites worth of data through a Google update and be able to look at, you know, the aggregate of that and be able to make certain conclusions from the data that I see. But even then, it's like 100,000 sites worth of data. That's not statistically significant enough across traffic on Google search, even just for like, even if I was to narrow it down and say just like article-based sites or something like that. So not being able to have a statistically significant sample size from 100,000 sites, you know, picking out what one or two people have done, I would say like it really gives me pause. And that, yeah, I think the deleting content thing is a really good example of where I've seen that kind of it comes in and out of vogue because this was really hot like 6 or 7 years ago and now it's back. So
yeah, I read an article recently. I forget which major company was deleting content, but then I had a publisher reach out, should I delete my content too? I said no.
Yeah, don't do it. I've seen way more harm done than good. Most of the quote unquote good that I've seen has been sort of like, sure, maybe you also did like 100 other things. That's always been the experience that I've seen. But I've definitely seen sites where it's like, why did my traffic just drop by 25%? It's like, well, you deleted 25% of, you know, like the pages that got that traffic, they're gone. I don't know what you thought was going to happen. They're like, well, I redirected them. It's like to different articles.
Yeah. And then those pages aren't getting any traffic. They're not, they're getting no redirects. So yeah, it can cause a slew of issues.
Hi everyone. My name is Charlie and I'm a technical publisher advocate here at Zoic. And I'm here to tell you about Zoic Ads. Did you know that you can maximize your website monetization using a Zoic sophisticated AI? You can cater a different ad experience to each individual user going to your site. It's true. It's called Ad Tester, and you can automatically trigger multivariate testing to run thousands of experiments at once. You choose your goals and let a Zoic optimize each unique visit around them. Publishers have seen an increase of average monthly revenue by 36%. So what are you waiting for? Sign your site up to a Zoic and join the thousands of other publishers maximizing your revenue today.
And I think, you know, you mentioned updating content, and this is really an area where AI can help a lot. And one of the things in the news right now is, so Hugging Faces, which I'll kind of give a little bit of context as to what that is, they've been briefly in the news and out of the news and probably not getting the attention that they deserve because, so Salesforce recently led a $235 million funding round for Hugging Faces, increasing its valuation to $4.5 billion. I actually think it'll probably soar way past that over time if it continues to be what it is. So the funding will support Hugging Faces team growth, so, you know, headcount, things along those lines, and their efforts in, you know, open source AI collaboration. So this is a really big deal, and if you haven't heard about it on the show, because I think we've talked about it once before, I'd encourage our listeners to go check it out. So it may be intimidating at first if you're not, you know, if you're not technical, because you're going to be seeing a lot of things where it's like it's this online marketplace or library of open source AI data models, and not just even models, just sort of like AI based applications. So you are somebody that maybe has a significant amount of stock market data. You build a model out of it using AI. And now people that want to access AI to do something with the stock market can come use your model that has all this, you know, data that maybe other people don't have. And so it's this really helpful tool. And so you may go, Tyler, that's great. What do I do with that? What's cool about Hugging Faces recently is they've opened up an area called Spaces. And what Spaces is it allows a really simple, free way to basically try out these different models. So text to audio, audio to video, video to text, you know, and then all these just different variations of it. Like we were playing with one the other day, it turns text into a jingle. So like, you know, you want to have a jingle for your business or for the, you know, your podcast or something like that, which we should do. You know,
Zoic.
Yeah, it's really funny. We that's kind of was the use case. And I think one of our, the guy that did it the best, he found this one that kind of has this auto-tune voice that spelled out the letters to our company's name with the 7653309. I was like having trouble remembering the number for whatever reason. I could just, it's just Mike Jones in there for me. But I think, I think it's really, really interesting. And I would encourage publishers to check it out because it really is the forefront of a lot of the things that you're seeing in AI right now. And I, you know, have there been things that have surprised you over the last 6 months?
Yeah, I'm surprised at how reluctant a lot of publishers and how afraid publishers are of AI, where I see the early adapters of this technology really soar in terms of their content production, how many articles they're able to publish every month compared to previously, and just the trends over time. Talking to publishers a year ago, the common theme would be, I'm struggling to find writers. I'm struggling to find writers for my content. Where now, publishers can utilize AI to help them create content faster and easier than ever before.
Yeah, I'm very, you know, I was probably for the first month after ChatGPT, I was sort of in that boat where I was not really 100% sure how disruptive this could be to publishers. But, you know, it's very apparent to me now that, you know, this should be something that gets embraced. And I think our listenership has heard me talk about this. And I would say they're probably largely of that breed. Listeners, if that's not the case, feel free to send me in your fears. Publisherlab.org. And the thing is that, you know, as a publisher, it's impossible to be an expert in all the things you need to be an expert in. And you don't want the overhead of a big media brand. Trust me, that's a nightmare. What you want to do is you want to basically look at AI as if you don't have a data scientist. Do you want to do data science? Great, now you got one. You want a graphic designer? Maybe you're not good at it, don't want to work on that stuff. Cool, now you got one. You want writers that are experts on these topics? You wanted to write an SEO optimized article? Great, now you have a writer that's all those things. And I think, you know, taking away the aspect of like, I'm the one that puts my hands on the keyboards right now and puts articles into the website, take yourself away from that and say, imagine if you just didn't have to waste the time physically touching the keyboard and, you know, spend your time really coming up with the ideas, doing the, what I like to think of as the fun stuff. You know, you can even have ChatGPT transcribe, you know, you can explain to it. There's a lot faster ways to run your business. And if you don't see that as a good thing, then you may just have a hobby.
Oh, yeah. Work smarter, not harder.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think we have a slew of AI tools, and it's exciting to be able to talk to publishers how with Flickify, you can take an article and make it into a video in less than 5 minutes. We're releasing a new niche IQ tool, Wordsmith, that's going to help publishers create content. So it's a really exciting time, and it's never been easier to create meaningful content for users. And I think, I know there's an article recently where they're talking about how like that AI is just going to eat itself with how much content is out there. And a majority of the internet is going to be AI written content. And just think of a way as how can you make yourself stand out from everyone else? And I think people will gravitate towards content that is written by a user, but it can have the help of AI. With prompts, with layout, and then just adding your expertise, authority, and trustworthiness in conjunction with AI, I think will really help publishers in the long run.
Yeah, and I mean, you should be the broadcaster, not me. It's a great, like, again, segue into our final story, which was this one about like nutrition labels for AI, and AI needing to almost sort of like label what is created by, you know, AI and what's not. And even getting into the sort of like idea of like what models, what information was this open source? Like, where did it come from? Like, how is this stuff getting generated? And you mentioned that the part about, you know, AI eventually becomes this sort of like, it's generating a lot of information and content, and then it's also feeding off of it. I don't see this as being a huge problem because I think the answer to AI a lot of times is more AI, surprisingly. it sounds very irresponsible, but I do think that that surprisingly is the case in many instances. But you do have AI that is training other AI models on this stuff. And you brought up a point that I hadn't really looked at from this perspective before, but I think it drives home something that I would tell our listeners and all publishers, which is, you know, if you're concerned about sort of like the way that AI can, you're worried that other people will use it and it's going to, you know, be disruptive and something along those lines, you can almost look at, you know, step back, look at your, you know, sites or site the way that a business would look at their business and go, you know, why is it that there are, you know, thousands of restaurants out in the city that we live in, but only a handful actually succeed or, you know, continue to grow. Same thing for any kind of tech company or startup. Like, there's rarely any unique ideas, and why do some companies make it and others don't? And the answer is strategy. Think of yourself as the CEO of your business, mm-hmm. and, you know, the direction your content takes, the decisions that you make, how you market your content, you know, who is the audience that you're going after, and like, what direction is that? You know, it's no different with having, you know, AI, you know, sort of like help you off in that path than it would be as if, you know, you were equipped with a, you know, office full of 50 people. You know, the business is not going to succeed and fail based on whether or not necessarily that it's a good business. It might just be on, what do you have those 50 people doing?
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why I'm always happy when publishers reach out to me for help, because what publishers are good at, they're good at creating content. They're good at drawing users to their site, and then utilizing all the resources that Ezoic has, we can be that staff for you. We have SEO experts who can do an audit on your site. We have speed specialists who can really dive into the core web vitals. We have revenue operations experts who can really dive into the data to see what ad placements are doing well with advertisers, so you can focus at the end of the day what you do well. So you leverage Ezoic for your needs and leverage AI for your needs. So it makes your job easier.
And I think that that's one of the things that's been true in my experience over two decades of publishing, is that if you're an independent publisher, meaning, you know, like small shop, you know, less than 10 people, usually, you know, the person that's sort of like running things, they have an area that they tend to be a pretty strong expert in. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's development, sometimes it's infrastructure, sometimes it's, you know, but most, like you said, most of the time it's content. And the thing is that as businesses grow, once you get out of that sort of independent small shop, 10 people, then you start getting, you know, hiring areas of expertise or outsourcing, you know, different areas of it. And what happens, and this is true for any business, is as it gets larger, the interests of those that are sort of like the caretakers of these different things that maybe you don't want to have to handle or you don't have the expertise to handle, those things tend to get less sort of like of your interests, sort of like driving them forward, as they do the interest of whatever other party, whether it's an employee, you know, an outsourced shop or something like that. What ends up happening when that takes place is that your business can get off track really quickly, and you could be missing out on things because ultimately not having that expertise makes it so that, you know, whatever your interests are, because maybe if you knew everything that an expert did, you would do something slightly differently. It's how do you have the context of, what decisions do I have to make and how am I making the right one? And I think, you know, being able to have trusted people that you work with, and then really AI can be that in a lot of regards, because you can use it to figure out, like, you know, plain language, I want to do X. This is my ultimate goal. Like, what are the downsides of this strategy or that strategy? Mm-hmm. I don't think people use it enough for sort of like strategic, like just like double checking yourself. You know, if you don't have somebody that you can trust, we talked a couple weeks ago about AI friends. I don't know. Maybe that's the next big thing. It's like, I don't trust my friends. I don't trust my wife. I don't trust my kids. AI, I need you to hit me with it straight. Give me the truth. I don't know. It's an interesting time, but I'm curious to see, what do you think of these AI nutrition labels? Is this something that's probably good or bad? Or
I think overall it's good. And what I always recommend to my publishers when they're creating content, having that this was written by this author and it was last updated and published on this date, as well as having a little author blurb at the bottom of the content, because I don't know about you, but I really resonate with content where I know like who's writing it. And sometimes I'll follow content specifically if it's written by a certain person, because I like that person's writing style. I like that person's humor. So I'll seek out that content if I know it's written by that person. And if it's written by AI, I might look at it a different way, or I might be viewing that content for a different subset of needs.
You know, it's funny because I do the exact same thing. And sometimes I'll read an article and I'll, at the bottom, especially if it's like embedded news where it's like, you know, the journalist who got this information is in Ukraine or something like that, I'll read about that person, or I'll read that bio at the bottom, and that'll add credibility for me about the reporting. Because obviously if you're a journalist and you're embedded in Ukraine right now, that's something that I would say is like, not like you didn't just wake up on a Tuesday and you're home in Connecticut and decide that you were going to like, I think I'll go to Ukraine today from 9 to 5. But at the same time, you know, a lot of times I'll be looking at something like Market News or something like that, where it's like, it'll tell me up at the top that it's AI written, but maybe checked by an editor or something. And my first thought is great. Cause I just want the facts of this, you know? But I do think that one of the things that I imagine our publishers say in their minds when they think of like, you know, identifying to users that this was written by AI and how, or, you know, whether you put the nutrition labels on, somebody else, you know, forces your hand one day or something like that. I think that it's ultimately good, because you have to just forget that Google exists for a second and just imagine, is there a problem with telling your audience more about the content and how it was created? And if the answer is yes, then maybe evaluate the content, you know, because ultimately it's like, if I knew that maybe some information that I was reading came from an AI, but maybe one that's particularly well fed in with information or data from something, that adds credibility for me, doesn't take away from it, especially if I want something where the truth, or like, you know, the facts, or, you know, best practices, or something that like maybe I would question with anybody.
Yeah, at the end of the day, is the content comprehensive? Does it cover the whole subject completely? And sometimes I'll read content and it doesn't. And then sometimes I'll read content and I was like, oh yeah, this is over 3,000 words. This really covers everything in depth. It covers parts of the topic that I didn't even realize I wanted to know until I started reading the content.
I have both. I have both that where it's just like, oh, well, that's interesting. I was reading about something the other day. One of my dogs, she's 14. And so she has like a little bit of dementia, we think, but she's always been weird. So it's hard to say. But either way, I was reading about it. And then they were talking about these other things that were sort of like interconnected. And they mentioned one thing in particular where I was like, oh, what's that? Like, and then I'm like down a rabbit hole on the site. And I'm not the first person to go down a WebMD, you know, like rabbit hole thinking that I have like the rarest form of tropical diseases or something. But I do think that there is an aspect of, again, knowing your audience and being able to give them information that they don't know that they want, that they do, versus sort of like, I heard that Google really likes it when I just chuck as many, you know, related topics into an article as possible. Because I can't think of anything that's a worse experience than where I'm like, hey, where was Abraham Lincoln born? And then I got to read past like where he went to elementary school and who his dad was. You know, it's like, I just want that piece of information, you know? But yeah, I think that it's been a lot of fun kind of seeing how things evolved over time. I guess before we finish, is there anything else that you think that publishers need to be thinking about or looking forward to? Or is there anything that's happened recently that, you know, somebody has done that sticks out to you as being particularly well thought out?
Yeah. So I just did a weekly webinar recently on some like very easy tips on things that I constantly see publishers miss out on. One of them being linking their AdSense account to eZoic. It's extremely easy. And the thing with eZoic is we don't take a cut of AdSense revenue, and it just adds more competition to your site because you have eZoic ad partners, the Google Ad Exchange, and you have AdSense bidding on your site. So linking AdSense is an easy way to increase EPMV and revenue, and also just diversifying your revenue stream because you have cost per click and you have cost per impression. So definitely linking AdSense. I think GDPR, consent management, it's going to become more of a thing. And making sure you have a consent management privacy policy on your site is something that I see some publishers overlook or not think it's important. But over time, advertisers look at that stuff and they want to be bidding on sites that have those privacy policies, that GDPR, that CCPA on their site. So I would definitely look at that. And then in terms of content growth and thinking about quarter four, like utilizing all the SEO tools that we have with topic suggestions, which is pretty much finding keywords that can rank really well for your site and drive in traffic, and page boosters, where you can really put your finger on the pulse of your website and see what pages are trending up, which pages are trending down. And for those pages that are trending down, you can even look at like the loss in traffic for specific keywords. You can look at Google and see what is ranking ahead of you. And you can easily do an on-page SEO audit right then and there. For example, I was working with a publisher who writes about the things to do in New York every week. And we saw that their page lost traffic. When we looked at Google, we saw that the things that were ranking ahead of them had the specific dates in the header. Things to do in New York, August 18th to the 28th. Yeah. And they weren't doing that. And it was like, oh, well, this is an easy fix. Let's change that header when we update that content every week, and we can make your site more competitive. So it's just doing those little things like that. And then I touched on it earlier, but video content is definitely something to think about. A stat that really made my eyes open is that an article with a video receives 83% more traffic than an article without a video on it.
Yeah, it really is incredible in that regard, because I think what people don't realize is that if you are putting video on your site, especially if you're self-hosting it or uploading the videos directly, that's something that you're getting traffic from the video being in Google's video index. So Google just so happens to have the three largest search engines: Google search. The second is not YouTube, as people often say. YouTube is number three. Number two is Google video and images. So kind of a trick question, I feel like, a little bit, but technically they're all three separate search engines. And because of that, that traffic that gets added, it doesn't necessarily just come from, you know, how you think of somebody typing in a word and then going on and clicking a result. It's in images, it's in video. So I think that that's something that often gets passed over without really maybe knowing or understanding it. But yeah, thanks again, Trevor, for coming in and sharing a little bit more about, you know, sort of like the boots on the ground of like modern publishing. And thanks for helping me navigate through this week's stories. I'm gonna have to have you be my segue guy from here on out.
No worries, Tyler.
And we want to thank everybody else for joining us and listening. If you have questions or comments, or, you know, there's a particular subject you want to touch on more, Trevor talked a little bit about programmatic advertising at the end there. And it's definitely a subject that I have a lot of knowledge and information on. I sort of avoid it. You guys know me, I'm a little bit cynical and jaded by our industry. So I may avoid certain topics or subjects sometimes, but if there's something you really want to hear about, let us know at publisherlab.org, and watch us on YouTube if you want. If you just listen, check it out. And if you're just like, no, I just want to listen, you can listen to us on podcast platforms everywhere. And I think that's it. Thanks everyone for watching another episode of The Publisher Lab.